In this video, we are going to be talking about the Ingmar Bergman film that he both wrote and directed from 1955, Smiles of a Summer Night. My guest today is Nathan Jones. He's one of my Bergman partner in crimes, I like to call him. We've had some wonderful talks about Bergman and other films over the in the last year or so. He has a YouTube channel himself, which is dedicated to physical media and different film reviews. Nathan, welcome back. I'm glad that you could be here again.
Well, thanks, Robert. Yeah, no, I'm thankful to be back talking about Bergman because he's definitely one of those filmmakers that just is, he's like the gift that keeps on giving, or maybe taking away, because in this case it's giving, because yeah, it's definitely a lot more lighthearted, but obviously through his filmography you get the whole spectrum of human emotion, so which is just fun. So I'm glad to be back.
This was my first viewing of this film. I hadn't seen it before, so I'm curious, how many have you seen it more than once, and if so has your experience changed over seeing it on repeat viewings? Have your feelings changed about it at all?
Yeah, I've seen this movie about three times now, the last time being recently for this. This was actually the first film that I watched in the box set, because it's curated this way, right, for the Ingmar Bergman, unboxing, Ingmar Bergman Cinema, for people who know about this Criterion release. Yeah. It's the first film that is curated there from, and that was kind of how I started with this journey. I had seen Seventh Seal and Wild Strawberries before, even Persona, but those are the movies I didn't follow in order with that. But once I started that, over 2 years ago now, I had watched it again, maybe last year, and then again this time. And I would say on repeat viewing, I've only grown a more fondness towards the film, because there's a lot going on. It's easy to follow for sure. But there is definitely a lot of relationships to follow. And there's a lot of really great dialogue to keep up with. And there's a lot of things that you can kind of catch, the more you see it, the more things you catch. And it's like, there's some subtle innuendos and things like that. The subtleties make it a really fantastic revisit and a rewatch.
I agree with that, because there's so much going on, and I haven't seen him tell a story with this kind of tone. Like, I know this is not one, I know he did a few comedies, and I suppose I probably know his work more from post Seventh Seal, but this is still like just before that, and I know it was a real breakthrough for him as well, just in terms of box office, not just in Sweden, but from all over the world. I'm curious, is there any indication as to why it's the first film curated on that box set? I wonder why that was chosen as the first one to go with.
I think it's a really good idea of maybe getting the fact that he is Bergman, at the center of a lot of Bergman's things are relationships, and right, and how those relationships play out, not always romantic necessarily, but with this one, I think is a really good start from that angle. But also at the same time, this is like one of his lightest films, but it's also like one of those sharp films too. There was a little bit of I feel like a critique.
There's like the class divisions, like the bourgeois,
the upstairs downstairs kind of. Downton Abbey, you'd think that kind of stuff. But yeah, there's like a little bit of a sharp like witticism towards like class, and then also it's like comedic. I think it's a good starting off point for people who maybe aren't so, like, they're not going to go straight for the Seventh Seal or Persona, heavier stuff. You're not going to go straight for those. You want to ease into a festival like this. So I feel like if the curation's like this, you want to ease into it. And I feel like this is a really great start to that. And also like kind of like the creme de la creme of his early works, if you will, like before Seventh Seal, right? It's like the pinnacle of like, yeah, I feel like of these early works for him, and especially in with like Gunnar Fischer, like his cinematographer,
right,
at that time. I think this is definitely one of the prettiest films too to look at as well. We'll get to that, I'm sure, but.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that's a good point, because it certainly has beneath the light touch of the film in the comedy, and even the fact that even the score is very light and humorous, he still has a real darkness to the relationships and to the characters. So, which of course, you know, you'd certainly see in the 60s and 70s that he really went directly for the more complex natures of relationships and the darker sides. He goes right for the jugular. So I think this is a good introduction to sort of ease you into those themes and those feelings and those kind of relationships, but, you know, in a comedic way. I mean, to me, it's very Shakespearean in the sense in Shakespeare's comedies, like the Comedy of Errors and
Midsummer's Dream. Yeah.
Midnight Summer's Dream. And even if you look at some of the plots that particularly the women are up to later on in this film, before that big party, when they're going to get everybody together and you don't know what exactly they're up to, but they have this plot to basically, you know, make sure that, you know, one of them can get their husband back, and then the other one can get the man who she loves out of his marriage to be with her. And, you know, if you look at, and the way they do it is there, it is funny. And if you look at even like Shakespeare's Othello, like Iago is constantly plotting, and a lot of his plots in order to bring down Othello are hilarious, but yet we don't think of that play that way, because it is very dark, but it has a certain dark sense of humor to it. So one wonders if Shakespeare was an inspiration here for Bergman. But aside from that, even though there's a lot of characters, you know, it's a little more plot heavy than perhaps some of his other films. What do you think it's truly about what do you take away from it from your perspective?
I think it's interesting because it's like a combination of like that cynical thing that we're talking about. Like obviously humans and relationships can be really, I guess, I think the really great speech by Frid, who's one of the servants in this, to Petra, the two servant characters necessarily in particular, where it's more of like breaking the fourth wall for the audience. And yeah, like when that
they
scene
feel like
where
narrators to an extent.
Right.
Yeah.
They're on the outside and they're sitting under that tree in the movie. And, you know, he starts talking about the, you know, the world of lovers and like how there's such a small number of them. And the rest of us are on the outside wanting it, tasting it. We think we have it, all that stuff. I think there's that cynical nature, and then there's also that romantic sense that we get from like movies and also these like fairy tales, or even something like, you know, Shakespeare's plays, or maybe this is more like a French comedy as well. There's like those elements there. There's like an element of realism and also an element of cynicalism towards relationships, but also at the same time, I love how the ending is a little bit more towards the fairy tale side of things, where it's a little bit more, I guess the perfect thing to see is like, you know, that little Cupid blowing the trumpet when like the beds come out. Like it's almost like that moment, right? That triumphant moment is like, oh, you know, like here's your dreams come true, this kind of a thing.
Exactly. Yeah. It is overly simplified, but I think that's part of the charm, as you said, like the Cupid, like it's part of, it has that fairy tale aspect to it. Yeah, that's a good point, because I didn't necessarily think of it in terms of fairy tale. And when things were sort of wrapped up and everybody more or less gets what they want, part of me was like, oh, come on, really? But then I could see why he was doing that, because it's meant to be tongue in cheek, and these people, at the same time, they experience a lot of growth in the story. Because I think ultimately it's like people, their quest for love and finding love, and everybody is with the wrong person,
right?
Which I find so fascinating. And just, you know, looking at the cast, for example, I'm so bad with pronouncing a lot of these Swedish names. Of course, Gunnar Bornstrand, who he used in many of his films, Winter Light, among others. You know, he's married to this young woman, Anne Egerman is a character played by Ulla Jacobson. And it's so fascinating because he thinks he loves her. But it, of course, it's that scene where at night he is, you know, he wakes up in a bit of a dream, and they're right. kissing, and he says Desiree, which is his ex lover's name. And she's a famous actress played by Eva Dahlback. And she was, of course, in a number of his films as well. And then, you know, this really dark relationship where hit with his son.
Right.
Who's clearly in, it's not so clear until later that he's actually in love with like his stepmom, you know, who's younger than him.
Same age as Henrik though, ish, same, yeah.
Yeah, they're like around the same age. And you can see how he was certainly, Bergman was certainly making those suggestions strong. Like what, for example, she smacks him because he was flirting with Petra, who's the housekeeper played by Harriet Anderson. And, you know, why would she do that other than because she's jealous? You know, I mean, why would she really care? So there's something going on there. And then, of course, the soldier character, who was like he's like the buffoon of the piece to me. I'm just trying to find the actor's name here.
Is it Jarl Kuhl? Who plays Count Carl Magnus Malcolm?
Yes, that's him. Yeah. Thank you. You know, it's just, I mean, for me, he was like the epitome of a macho man. I guess what people today would call toxic masculinity, let's say, right. Or, you know, because he's like, he's a soldier. Not that it's toxic to be a soldier, but he looks at a soldier because he's a quote unquote man who can shoot things. And he's constantly like shooting things, even in his house. And, you know, he cheats openly on his wife and tells her about it as if he has the right to do it. And this is all of a disguise because he actually, as we find out, he actually does really love his wife. It's just that his idea of a man is someone who has to constantly prove himself. So it's almost as if him and Gunnar wear these masks, you know, like that they struggle to take off because they have these ideas of what men are, and that men are these kind of macho types who right. cheat on their, you know, cheat or perhaps
play Russian roulette.
Yeah, the Russian roulette scene. Yeah. And perhaps Gunnar, I wonder if he's with this woman, this young woman, just because it's like she's like a trophy wife, you know? I mean,
right.
They haven't even had sex or anything for 2 years. And I think he thinks he loves her because he goes to Desiree and basically says to her, tell me if this is hopeless, you know, and that's why she, you know, creates that party later. But I really just thought that he was someone who was very surface and wanted the appearance of, look at this woman I'm with, look at this woman I'm with. And he has those pictures of her he's taking, and he's, and there's even that great moment where he looks at the pictures later. He says her name out loud when he's alone, but there's no coloring of feeling. There's really nothing between them. And it's just so interesting what that does to the son, because he's this guy who's becoming a priest, and at the same time he's impotent. And everyone mocks him about that, you know, and no one helps him. So I really think this element, I think he was really ahead of its time in that sense, Bergman, and saying he was sort of poking fun at a certain kind of men who destroy themselves because of these facades. You know, I don't know if that was something that registered with you, Nathan.
Yeah, I would say so too. I mean, for me, I think it's a combination of also a lot of the times with Bergman, a lot of his characters come from his own reality. So
right.
I think And Bergman's like notoriously egotistical and narcissistic, right? And so I feel like some of these insecurities that he has were put into these characters as well. And I'm sure he saw those things about himself. And
he was pretty honest with himself about himself.
Yeah.
Brutally.
And I think it makes me think too, like I know we're going back to thinking about how it ends, and it's a little bit more fantastical, or you know, more like how a movie should end, right? When you say that in like a very fantastical way, I think because I know that Bergman was strugging success, just in general. I think that also played a role in this, and this was definitely
tone. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, because he probably would have been a little bit more cynical.
I think he would have
helped himself.
I think he would have went right to the jugular, because even he said, you know, beneath the comedy is a very dark story. And it's true. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have like a son in love with his stepmother, and you know, that's as dark as things can get, you know?
Yeah. And then there's all those innuendos there with all the characters. I mean, like how, and I don't know. I mean, obviously Sweden, especially around this time, is way more open than the United States, where
you can certainly see that
different types of like what constitute as suggestive or things like that, whereas it's definitely a lot more out in the open, or you get those clues a lot more so out in the open and out to dry.
They obviously didn't have I don't know what their censorship laws were in Europe or Sweden at that time. I mean, perhaps they didn't have much, because I mean, there's, you know, they openly talk about sex, or they openly, you know, there's that one scene where even Harriet Anderson, I mean, she's not naked, but she like opens up her shirt to show the son who's becoming a priest, where in the States, you know, you couldn't, even at that time, you would have had to have only suggested it. Everything would have been highly coded. I was really fascinated by the character, the son who's becoming a clergyman. I just want to get his name up here. I don't know if you have it handy.
Henrik Egerman. Bjorn. I'm going to say his name wrong.
They're so hard to say.
It's hard. It's B, like B, like Vefelsen, Vefelstam, or something like that.
Let's just say Henrik.
Henrik, son of Frederick.
Because I can see immediately the hostility he has for his father. And his father, you know, is mocking what he does for a living and doesn't really help him with his problems. That, you know, he's talking about that he can't perform and sexually, and even he obviously slept with Petra, and you know, he just talks about it. You don't see anything about that. But, you know, later on, after that big dinner scene, when he just loses it on everybody, because even the character starts to make fun of what the soldier starts to make fun of what he does. And when he hangs himself, and it's done, you know, in a funny way, because he tries, and even the whatever he tied, it wasn't even a rope. He tied something around his neck that just snatched. And I really wondered what drove him to that. I mean, what I thought was because he didn't feel he measured up to a quote unquote what a man was, like his father and, you know, the soldier character, guys with quick with the trigger or something along those lines, that he felt he was doomed in life. I don't know what you thought about that.
Well, maybe I know that I'm not quoting it directly, but I know that Bergman was at this point really in the gutter. And I think he made a joke or something about the lines of either I'm going to go kill myself or make this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Like,
and I honestly think that that ties into that whole, you know, there's those two characters with Frederick and the Count who are a little bit more macho, whereas, you know, Henrik is lacking in those things. And there's that dichotomy. There's that balance that he's looking towards, where it's like, am I good enough to do these things? But also, should I feel bad enough that I'm lacking these things?
Right.
And therefore, I'm going to, you know, comically try to kill myself. Obviously, and it leads to a really funny, but also charming scene. Right.
Yeah. I love that. Because then he just... He runs away with his with his stepmother, so to speak. And I really liked her a lot, Ulla Jacobson. character. She plays Anne Eagerman. Do you think that she got with Google? I mean, they don't, I like that they don't explain the backstory of how these people got together, because it enriches the experience. I thought, you know, that she perhaps married Gunnar because of a father complex of some kind, because you don't really know how she feels about him, because she very easily runs off with the son, you know? So I don't know what you thought about that.
Oh, I mean, yeah. I mean, something you could see kind of in the background. It doesn't have to be explained necessarily, because I mean, there is that almost father daughter relationship thing that's going on there. And, you know, I mean, she even said it, it's like, I see him as like a dad, like a father.
Yeah, that's right. Figure. Yeah.
And with that whole concept, you know, seeing that kind of unfold, and it makes it really awkward, obviously. But the one thing that I would say that maybe I feel like could have been better is more interactions with Henrik and Anne, to see that build up a little bit more.
Yeah, it was pretty vague. Yeah,
right.
I mean, it was there just enough, but yeah, it was quite thin. I know what you mean.
But yeah, I mean, other than that, though, I feel like, you know, with her, I know that she mentioned, like, you know, you were so lonely that one summer. And I think that's like, that's where how they met.
That's right.
And so with that being said, like, I think he was down in the dumps, maybe from, you know, Desiree. Maybe that was the case during that particular thing, because he had a marriage beforehand. That's where Henrik came from.
Right.
He was down in the dumps and found her. And, you know, that was like just a stepping stone, like a trophy wife or whatever you would say, or, you know, a daughter, something to pour himself into, where it's not, he's like kind of half pouring himself into something and not really doing the whole thing.
Yeah. Like a rebound, so to speak.
Right.
You know, because why would you go to your ex lover that you're clearly hung up on to solve your problems with your current wife? You know, it makes no sense, you know, which I mean, not as a criticism, but because he thinks he's doing the right thing, but it's because he's obviously feeling and attracted to Desiree. And even that scene where he goes to the theater to talk to her, and she just will openly get it changed in front of him. She'll let him, you know, watch her in the bath. And, you know, he was complimenting her, you know, in a very sexual way. And you could see right there and then that this guy and this woman were totally in love, but he's just totally confused. So she really has to get him back on track, so to speak, which of course she achieves. And I also really like the scene with her mother. You know, they have this idea to throw this party and invite everybody. And, you know, there's a great POV shot where from Desiree's point of view, which very much puts us in that perspective, where her mother, who seemed very comedic at that point, she says something about, you know, there's nothing I can do to stop any of your human suffering. And I thought it was really interesting. It was just that showing that sort of parental moment of, like, you know, your daughter's out in the world, and, you know, like, she's obviously hung up on someone, and you don't know how this is going to go for her. And it just has this moment of concern I thought was quite universal, people's, you know, concern for their kids when they're out on their own. I don't know if that popped out to you at all. It's very brief.
Yeah. You know, you talking about it expands upon it a little bit. I didn't think about it at the time, but yeah, certainly I feel like it's one of those things that, you know, is very adult for her to, or at least she's got an idea of the fact that, like, everything is not a fairy tale. It's not something that will come just because you think it's supposed to be a certain way. It's not what it is. You'll never know what the true form of, like, what love looks like, because everyone's so different, and you love what you love. And I mean, even like with the Count and Countess, like, that relationship is like, you know, to me, it's like, ugh, I don't want, I want them both to be separated, right? Even though they, you know, they end up together. It's like, I don't like that. But it's their own version of how they love each other. And, like, you know, it's who am I to judge how they, you know, relate with each other and how they come together. It's kind of the same way where she joked about being thrown out the window. It's like, well, she comes from, you know, maybe that's their version of what love looks like, but everyone else's version is different.
I know what you mean, because the count and the countess, you know, he's having all these affairs, and you wonder, well, why does she love this person? And she has that great, really great scene, which is such a, what I would call like a Bergman-esque scene, where it's like an extreme close-up, where she goes and talks to Anne, and she talks about how she hates her husband. And she says it in with such a viciousness, like, I hate him, I hate him, I hate him. She says it over and over again, but then she says she just can't help but love him, you know? And I think it's because she knows that underneath all of that is someone who, like, is a loving guy. And in, like, in order to get him back, she just had to make him jealous, you know? And that whole thing that they come up with Desiree obviously works in her favor. So I really like that, because I just thought, on the one hand, I don't know how well that would hold up today, you know, to see a guy like that still be loved. But at the same time, I think, you know, people do hurt each other all the time, but are still very much in love, and you just move on, you know. And I know what you mean, because it has an ickiness to it. It just doesn't sit quite right, but then at the same time it does. Which performances stood out to you the most in this film?
I quite enjoyed Petra and Frid. I think they were like the court gestures, of course, of the servants. I had a lot of fun with them. I especially loved Petra. Your first introduction to her, she's like swinging her hips.
Yeah.
And Henrik. Yeah. Henrik's like, stop doing that. And then she's like, stop doing what? And then
she was really good. I haven't seen her do, you know, when I think of her, I think of like Cries and Whispers and Summer with right. Monica. But she's so funny in this. I mean, it was a really different side to her. And you know, you touched on those class divisions earlier, and it's true, because if you look at her and Fritz, they're like having a great time, they're rolling in the hay, and everyone else is like miserable. The bourgeois are like stuck in these, you know, these you know, are confused and stuck in delusions and are trying to break out of them. And even in the very first scene where Gunnar is at work, and as soon as he leaves, you see that the people who work for him are making fun of him, you know, so what does that say about him, you know? And as myself, who's, you know, worked entry-level jobs and stuff like that, I mean, often, not always, but you can have perhaps people at the top who are not very kind, and you do make fun of them. Yeah. Right. Or you do, and yeah, and you really saw that with the people who were below them, but yet those are the people who are having the most fun. And I think that was Bergman sort of you know, siding with people who are, you know, not you know, pretentious or highly rich. You know, he obviously had, you know, he was a pretty ordinary person in some ways, not the depth of his complexity, but he wasn't sort of someone who tried to show off any kind of money or anything like that. I mean, I don't even think in Sweden at that time, they would even really get paid that much. I know as much as he spent in the theater, like, and that's kind of is the same to an extent today with even big theater productions, like they were just sort of middle class in a lot of ways, you know? So I thought that was, I don't know if that class was something that popped out to you.
Yeah.
Really popped out to you in this film.
I'd say so too. But I also think that, you know, regardless of both servants having like the most fun, I guess, being, you know, those characters outside, maybe more on the audience side of things, I also feel like they were having their own struggles, you know? I mean, obviously, you saw Petra, you know, get really solemn when, you know, after they were having a lot of fun, and then Frid was like, look at the sunset, you know, like, and you know, he's talking about the different smiles of the summer night, of course. Yeah. And she, I think that really, like, we, I think it's really, really well done, from the fact that I feel like a lot of us trick ourselves into the fact that like, oh, like I'm okay. I'm having all this fun doing these things. And yet we still feel so alone.
Right.
Because, right. You know, we're pretending, right. We're pretending to, you know, be okay. Whereas maybe everyone who's in the bourgeois look and like they're so miserable because they know of like all this triviality stuff that this like, you know, kind of, you know, plaguing themselves. But it's also something that, you know, people who are maybe less fortunate are also dealing with, because they have to deal with like, well, how do you cope with this? Like, well, I cope with it by trying to make fun of it or, you know, try to have fun with it and drink or whatever.
Or really just live in the moment. You know, I think Fritz just kind of like, he was really living for that season and that, you know, the weather at that time. And of course that plays heavily on this as well. Cause I was just watching a little featurette on the Criterion channel, and one of the film scholars was saying, you know, like in Sweden, the summers, and you know, it's even when in Canada, it's like that here, often too. It's like when it's summer, because it's cold a lot, we're like, people just die for, you know, heat. And of course, he's using that as a metaphor for passion and love and sex, right? So clearly, and you see that to an extent with summer with Monica as well.
Right.
Having those feelings because of the temperature, because of the seasons. And I really like that, because it's true. I mean, I don't think about that as consciously in life as I should, because I think there is something to say about seasons and different passion. Temperatures and how it affects our mood and love life and stuff like that. So I really like that. I don't know if that popped out to you at all.
No, I mean, honestly, I think you hit the nail on the head with this, something that I don't think a lot of us think about necessarily too much.
Right.
It's just something that happens naturally with the environment and what we're doing around us. And I think summer, more people are out, you know, doing things. They're at lakes, beaches, rivers, whatever, having picnics or something like that. They're more social. The weather's more pleasant, you know, that can affect our emotions and our behaviors, and therefore, you know, things can happen in a more passionate way, maybe towards that. This is not always the case, but in a general social sense, I feel like that was the case. And so things like these are like a breath of fresh air type of film.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's how it feels. Yeah.
Oh, no, I couldn't agree more. That's absolutely true. Was there anything else you wanted to mention about this film?
No, I just think, I will say that, like, you know, I think I barely mentioned it, but the dialogue, it's just, I think is just like phenomenal. It's definitely one of those things that, like I said, with repeated viewings, it's definitely sharpened for me. And it's been very interesting to kind of catch all those little things that you don't see beforehand, because there's always that Shakespearean element, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Those little quips and those little, you know, innuendos that people are throwing at each other. And like, you know, there's that gossip, I suppose, in a way, which most of us say we don't like it, but in film, like that's the stuff that like drives a lot of, the script or the dialogue in general is like that. And I think that's what makes it so interesting to a lot of us. So it's a very fun film. I would highly recommend it to people who haven't seen it. I'm sure a lot of people who are watching this probably have seen it, hopefully, because we've went all over the place with the plot. But
yeah, I'm all spoilers here, as I often say. No, very, very true. And of course, it is on the Criterion channel if you haven't seen it, or if you have that Bergman box set that came out by the Criterion collection that Nathan has, just came out a few years ago. That's spectacular. And you can check out Nathan's great channel on YouTube as well. I'll leave the link in the description box below. And where's the best place for people to find you on social media? I know you're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
Yeah, I would say find me. I do most of my film related things on Twitter and Instagram as well. Finding me on YouTube is good. That's usually where I post a lot of my film related content. And then, I would say Twitter and Instagram are pretty safe bet as well. Thank you so much for having me on, Robert.
No, my pleasure. Thank you for coming. I always enjoy these Bergman conversations, or anything else we discussed. So please come again to do some more. I hope you can, I know you're a busy guy, but I hope we can make it work again sometime soon.
We definitely will. I mean, I still have a lot of Bergman films to watch. I still haven't finished.
Oh, God. Me too.
I know.
Me too. Well, thanks so much. And for those of you in the audience, there is also an audio version of this podcast. So actually, if you're listening to the audio version right now, it's available on any of the platforms where audio podcasts are found. And not everything that is on the YouTube channel is on the audio version. So if you're listening right now, head over to YouTube to see a lot more. And lastly, if this is your first time on the YouTube channel, please consider subscribing by pressing the Robert Bellissimo at the Movies logo. You'll see it floating above my head here to your top left. Just click on that and then click the bell in order to get a notification every time I release a new video or go live. It is absolutely free to subscribe. Thanks so much, everyone, and we'll see you in the next episode.